We wrapped up another busy week on Connecticut Today on Friday, June 19th. Republican State Rep Doug Dubitsky stopped by to talk about a lawsuit that he and two other Republican state legislators have filed in federal court against the Lamont administration's order that would suspend all eviction orders and processes by landlords in Connecticut during the COVID-19 outbreak. Dr. Gary Rose, who heads the Political Science Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, also stopped by to give us his thoughts on the current political climate. Now, to talk about a lawsuit that he and a few other Republican state reps have filed regarding one of the governor's orders here in the coronavirus lockdown over the past several months is Republican State Rep Doug Dubitsky. Doug represents Canterbury, Chaplin, Franklin, Lisbon, Sprague, Lebanon, Scotland, Hampton, and Norwich. Doug, Paul Pacelli here. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you, Paul?
I'm doing well. Thanks for taking out time of the day, Doug. I appreciate it. You and a couple of other members of the General Assembly have gotten together and have filed a court action, Doug, on something I know that's been another one of these kind of controversial things in some people's eyes the governor has done, and in the specter of this being a health emergency, that has to do with evictions and rents and renters and landlords. Talk about that a little. What does the lawsuit take into account here?
Well, what the lawsuit says is that the governor, without any statutory or constitutional power, has made orders that infringe on our clients' constitutional rights. So we've brought a 1983 claim action in federal court. That is a civil rights action. And we're claiming that the governor's order violates our clients' right to due process of law, violates their rights under the Contracts Clause, effects a taking of personal property without just compensation, and that it also violates the requirement for equal protection under the law, and that there's actually two orders, and that they're what's called ultra vires, and that ultra vires is a Latin word for meaning he's exceeding his power.
Mm-hmm.
What we're saying is that he simply has no legal authority to do what he's done, and that his actions are violating the fundamental constitutional rights of our clients.
And Doug, what he has done, I guess, is that moratorium, correct, on evictions and eviction notices. That's what we're talking about here, right?
Right. Well, there's actually several different pieces to it. There are two executive orders. One is Executive Order 7G, which essentially closed the courts to our clients, and there is a constitutional provision in the Connecticut Constitution that specifically says that the courts must stay open and that people with grievances must have access to the courts. And nothing in Connecticut statute and none of the power that the legislature has conveyed on the governor gives him the authority to override a constitutional provision that gives our clients the right to access the courts. So that's the first executive order that we believe is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. The second one is Executive Order 7X, and what that does is a couple of things. First off, it prohibits landlords from issuing notices to quit, which is a prerequisite for an eviction action. It prohibits them from filing an eviction action in the courts, and it prohibits them from executing on any judgment that they would have. So if they've already got a judgment of eviction, this order prevents them from executing on that and actually kicking the person out. And what we're claiming is that combined, those orders and those prohibitions strip our clients of their rights. The other thing it does, which is very important, is the order also says that a landlord who's holding a security deposit, so let's say they're holding 2 months security, which is pretty standard.
Yeah, first and last, yeah.
Correct. So the landlord is required to relinquish a portion of that to pay the tenant's rent if the tenant asks for it. So what we're claiming is that that provision is a taking without just compensation, because our clients have a security interest in protecting their properties, mm-hmm. and they're holding this money to pay for any damage to the property. And what the governor has said is, you now have to hand that over and surrender that money, and without any compensation. So we're claiming that's a Fifth Amendment violation of taking without just compensation.
All right, Doug, hang on. These are very interesting points. We'll get more into them. Doug Dubitsky is the guest state rep representing Chaplin, Franklin, Lisbon, Canterbury, Hampton, Lebanon, Scotland, Sprague, and Norwich. Doug, hang on. More discussion on this and the legal action filed against a couple of executive orders that you just heard that Governor Ned Lamont had signed. More with Doug after traffic and weather together. 2:36 on WICC. And we continue a few more minutes with Republican State Representative Doug Dubitsky, who's joining us right here on Connecticut Today for a sunny, warm Friday afternoon. Doug, along with State Representatives Craig Fischbein and Carla Pavlock-D'Amato, have filed a lawsuit against Governor Ned Lamont for his executive orders affecting, in some ways, in various ways, landlords and tenants, the landlord-tenant relationship here. You know, Doug, first of all, before we get into the particulars of what you mentioned, which are fascinating things, I see there has been a response to the suit that you and Representatives Fischbein and Pavlock-D'Amato brought from our Attorney General William Tong. Doug, it sounds a lot like the response he gave to the fingerprinting lawsuit for gun permits. We know how that all ended. And I'm wondering here if you were surprised at all by General Tong's response, and what are your thoughts are on that?
I was not surprised. It's his job to support the actions of the government, and whether or not they are supportable, he's going to get up in front of the press and say that they're perfectly legitimate and that they're going to win the suit. Even should he know that they're not. So I don't give much credit to the public statements about the suit. My guess is that's the same response they give every time they're sued, and I don't give much credence to that.
Doug, in filing this suit, I don't want to put words in your mouth or any of the other two reps that you got together and filed this, but my guess is here, Doug, that everybody recognizes that this is a health crisis here, a health emergency, and it was something that we never had, or at least this country has seen in 100 and change years, going back to the flu pandemic. But my guess is the argument from you and your compatriots and other folks going back to the gun lawsuit is, fine, we can take precautions here, but that doesn't mean that many of the foundational functions of government, both as deemed by the national constitution and the local constitution, should come grinding to a halt. Is that part of your argument here?
Well, essentially, the Constitution isn't suspended simply because there's a pandemic. There have been many pandemics throughout the history of our country, and the executive of a state, the governor, is given very broad powers to make orders and to change laws, but he has no power whatsoever to change constitutional provisions or to violate the constitutional rights of the people of the state. So his power is to make policy and change laws and issue orders which are within the boundaries, within the the guardrails of the Constitution. And, you know, that's an awesome power that he has. It is, you know, in many people's eyes, way too broad, that he can essentially bypass the legislature and make all his own laws. Whether or not you agree he should have that power, he has it. But he does not have the power to change the Constitution, whether the federal Constitution or the state Constitution. That is not within the emergency powers, nor can it be. So when he steps outside of those guardrails and that action hurts people of this state, it's up to the people and it's up to attorneys like myself and my colleagues, Representative Fischbein and Representative Pavlak D'Amato, as attorneys, to stand up and say, no, you can't injure our clients in this way. You have no power to do so.
Doug, I'm not asking you to get in the heads between the ears of any of the governor's legal counsel members or General Tong or his associates, but do you think at all that they may have known that, you know, Law 101, that this stuff, as you and your two compatriots say, is in fact too broad? But could the attitude have been, well, let's just go ahead and do this and let him come after us, or not? What do you think?
It certainly could be. You know, either they don't understand the limitations of the governor's power, or they don't care. Because one way or another, the governor took this action, and the state is almost certainly going to fight to uphold it. So, again, either they don't understand the limitations of the governor's power and that he has guardrails that he cannot exceed, or they figured, well, we don't really care. We can do it anyway. Who's going to stop us? Well, starting litigation is a very time-consuming, very intensive and very expensive endeavor. And thankfully, there are people who are willing to stand on principle and are willing to say, no, we are not going to allow the governor to exceed his powers, because if we allow it here, where will it stop? What else can he do? Once the Constitution is in the garbage, then where are the protections of the people of this state?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's in the governor's head or what's in Attorney General Tong's head. I do know that the actions that the governor took are unconstitutional, and we intend to establish that in a court of law.
Finally, Doug, what's the timetable? You went straight to the federal bench with this. Any idea of a timetable here?
Well, our clients are being injured irreparably every day that this order is in place. So what we've done is we've gone to the federal court and we've asked for an emergency. We filed an emergency motion for a temporary injunction or a temporary restraining order. And we assume and expect that this is going to move very quickly and that we will have a hearing within a few weeks. We anticipate that, you know, obviously, we filed a motion, which is a fairly extensive motion, almost 40 pages long,
mm-hmm.
Very thick legal brief. The governor is going to have an opportunity to respond to it, his attorneys. So that will be that will take some time. And then we will have an opportunity to respond to that. And then the court will schedule a hearing on it. After that, we expect a decision fairly quickly on whether or not the court will issue a preliminary injunction preventing the governor from enforcing those two executive orders, or at least the portions of it that we're objecting to. And then one way or another, this litigation will extend beyond that, and eventually there will likely be a trial of some sort. And, you know, the ultimate decision may take multiple months, may take up to a year, but we need to get our clients some relief from these orders, these unconstitutional orders, right away. It really is an emergency.
State Rep. Doug Dubitsky. Doug, thank you. We'll keep us updated on this, if you please, and we'll have you back. Doug, thanks. Have a happy weekend. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Doug. State Rep. Doug Dubitsky. Politics, both local, statewide, and national. We invite you to listen in as we have one of our go-to guys back on the program, Dr. Gary Rose, head of the Political Science Department, Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Gary, it's not like there's nothing going on. Jeez, I have no idea what we should talk about. What do you think?
I know. There are hardly any issues out there.
Is there some sort of a rally, a Trump appearance coming up this weekend? I'm not sure. Boy, Gary, where do we begin? First of all, good to hear from you. This whole Trump rally, he moved it because of Juneteenth. There's still controversy because it's in Tulsa. I think, Gary, though, do you get the sense that his campaign figures, look, this is a risk, but we have to get going here? I don't think they want to put out getting the candidate Trump back where he's best any longer.
Oh, he has to get going. The poll numbers are such that the Trump campaign realizes that this president has to get out of the White House. He's got to get on the road, and one of his strong points has always been meeting with thousands of people and those rallies, and that was very much responsible for his win in the Rust Belt states in 2016. And so I think they realized that, we can't wait any longer if we're going to really try to pull this election off, and we've got to get out there and start meeting the public. And so I'm not sure Tulsa was the best place to start because of the history of the city, the racial tension that has taken place in that city. And then, of course, the conflict with Juneteenth as well. But nevertheless, the Trump administration and Trump himself certainly is going to benefit from now, I think, meeting the people, which is really where he excels.
You know, Gary, I'm wondering to myself, because nobody else will listen. No, I'm wondering to myself, I wonder if Trump is picking Tulsa purposely to maybe try and turn the race issue on Democrats. In other words, we all know, Gary, after 3.5 years, he's not a traditional Republican who'll run away from this stuff. It almost seems to be like somebody said, no, let's not run away from this. Let's go to the belly of the torment right here, and let's try and flip the script maybe on this. I don't know. I don't know, Gary.
You know, I did think that myself, Paul. And, you know, I reflect back on, I believe it was President Reagan, Ronald Reagan, when he ran, he opened his campaign down in Mississippi, where the civil rights workers, there was several of them, if you recall, in 64, I believe it was, right, where they were murdered. And, you know, I was thinking, wow, you know, is this intentional? And then I started to think, well, maybe it is. Maybe he is taking this issue head on, and he's really, like, you know, in your face with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, in many ways, his style. And so there's that possibility. One side of me thinks that it is intentional, but I'm not 100% convinced yet. But it certainly did cross my mind.
And, you know, Gary, there's always this kind of rumor and rumbling out there. In fact, you're seeing numbers of it, Gary, which is interesting, about race and the Democrats here. I don't know whether you saw this. There was a Wall Street Journal article, which is, you know, a pretty reputable publication, citing unnamed but on the record Democrats who were saying, hey, you know what? Joe Biden's at 55% with Hispanics, which ain't great. They need 65 to win. And that same article stated, Gary, that there were Democrats admitting as soon as like 2 weeks ago that Trump is showing unusual strength, they said, with black males outside of the city. So, you know, again, this is another thing, Gary, that we just don't know, do we?
No, it's true. One of the strongest bases of support for Joe Biden. Really, within the Democratic Party, that is black females.
Yeah, yeah.
But black males, that's another matter. And when you start breaking the votes down of 2016, I mean, Trump got 8% total of the black vote. But at the same time, you really do see a significant gender difference within that. And it is true that a good number of black males these days, because of what took place before the virus struck and the economy, were benefiting mm-hmm. quite well under President Trump. And the record did show that, too. And so it doesn't surprise me that there is a it's interesting, among white voters, there's a gender gap. And yeah. even among black voters, there's a gender gap. Yes, that's true. And so there's that possibility that he, in some of these swing states, that black male voters could potentially swing this election. And a number of analysts are really watching that segment mm-hmm. of the electorate very carefully.
Gary, hang on. We'll be back with you. When we come back, I want to talk about the ever-ending quiz, or the never-ending quiz of Joe Biden's VP, talking about national politics. We'll talk about some state stuff as well with Dr. Gary Rose, who chairs the poli-sci department at Fairfield University. Straight ahead, though, traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. And we continue with one of our favorites, Dr. Gary Rose. He is a chair of the poli-sci department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Gary, this ongoing chess game, this kind of shell game, where's the ball, where's it hiding, every day with Joe Biden's vice presidential search. And sounds to me, Gary, like, former Senator Dodd and whomever's on his team there, his vetting team, it sounds like, Gary, there's a big roundtable debate saying, okay, what does this person get us, and what do we not get with this person? Because this is kind of an intriguing thing. It's as VP candidates usually go,
Yeah, yeah. I would say in this election year, the choice of a running mate is probably extremely important for Joe Biden. Not obviously Donald Trump. We know that Mike Pence is going to be his running mate, and he's going to be always playing just backup and second fiddle. But for Joe Biden, virtually everyone, I think, is under the impression that his vice president, whomever that might be, is going to be a significant player in a Biden administration, to the point where maybe almost like a shadow president with Joe Biden being 78 years old. And quite frankly, I've been watching him speak too, and there's something that's somewhat troubling about his thought processes, and everyone sees that. And so this choice of a running mate has tremendous significance this year with the Democratic Party.
All my friends, Gary, a lot of them anyway, on the other side of the aisle, ask me, how is it that the Democrats in this year ended up with Joe Biden? And Gary, you probably hear that too. I'm wondering, Gary, out loud here, if maybe they thought before coronavirus, before the unrest in the streets, before, all this racial stuff, if a lot of Democrats said, hey, you know what, he's probably going to win again. Let's make old Joe, the Bob Dole of this cycle, and let's not quote unquote waste a good young candidate. Let's wait for 4 years. I mean, I keep wondering that, if secretly, who knows, Gary, if they had polling that told him, Trump's probably going to win. What do you think of that?
Oh, that's an interesting observation. It's a possibility. But I would be inclined to say that the reason that Joe Biden is the nominee, I mean, obviously, James Clyburn was very significant there in the South Carolina primary mm-hmm. that propelled him into Super Tuesday. But he really was of the various candidates. I think they felt that that is the Democratic voters, that he was their best shot for beating Donald Trump. And so I'm not so sure they decided that this would just be sort of a year where they would, you know, just have a sacrificial lamb. But no, I think they actually did see Joe Biden as a distinct possibility of beating Trump, and of the various candidates, certainly between him and Bernie Sanders, Biden clearly was, I would say, the choice of the Democrats, who felt that we have to do it now. We really do. And so I think it was really electoral considerations more than anything else.
Okay, before we get to a couple of questions I want to ask you in our last segment about Governor Lamont and the state here, do you think, Gary, we may be heading into something else in this cycle that Richard Nixon famously dubbed the great, or as he said, the great silent majority? You know, is a lot of people, Gary, I mean, this unrest is happening in big cities. Is a lot of middle America just kind of watching this and saying, okay, all right, I'm writing all this down? I think that's a fascinating variable here.
I think there is that distinct possibility. There was, I should say, in 2016, definitely a hidden Trump vote. The polls did not find it in a lot of those swing states in the Midwest that you're referring to. And I am under the impression, actually, that that there is this. I'm not sure it's a silent majority, but it's nevertheless, I'm sure that the poll numbers are not completely accurate now. You know, with again, all of the social unrest that's going on right now, could you imagine if you were a Trump supporter and somebody called your house as a pollster asking you how you would vote? Would you really tell them how you feel about some of these issues and whether or not you're supporting this president, who is obviously a very polarizing figure? And so I agree with you, Paul. I think that the that Trump's support is considerably deeper than what the pollsters are finding right now.
Gary, hang on. I want to ask you about Connecticut politics and Governor Ned Lamont. Hang on. We'll be right back with you. Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Department Chair of Political Science. We'll ask him what he thinks of Governor Ned Lamont's progress in Term 1. First, traffic and weather together, 3:46 on WICC. A few more minutes here before we hit the news at the top and traffic and weather together again in less than 10 minutes with Dr. Gary Rose, Department Chair of Poli-Sci at Sacred Heart University. And Gary, of course, has written extensively and lectured about Connecticut politics as well. Gary, Governor Ned Lamont, I've watched him, as you undoubtedly have, during this whole COVID thing. Certainly, Gary, a different tone than we had for the 8 previous years with our previous governor, who, you know, reveled in, what do you call himself, a porcupine, I think? Ned Lamont, he is not afraid to seek counsel from his business contacts. He surprised a lot of folks, Gary, this week when he said he agreed, gasp, with Republicans about not extending, or, you know, the $600 a week federal unemployment. So certainly a different tone, Gary, than we've seen in a long time in the statehouse.
Yes, and what you mentioned there, the Wall Street Journal identified that today.
Yeah,
too. Yeah, yeah. Ned Lamont is his own man, and you're right. He doesn't have, by any means, that abrasive approach to working with members of the opposing party, or for that matter, even within his own party, as his predecessor did. And so Ned Lamont is his own man. He always has been, you know, even when he went on to challenge Lieberman for the nomination and, you know, over the Iraq War. And so when you see him up there speaking, I really don't think Ned Lamont is necessarily thinking about the next election, or, you know, how his positions are going to play out in public opinion polls, or how his positions are going to even affect his own political party. And we are witnessing, I think, in many ways a new type of Democrat up there. I think, obviously, when you're exceptionally wealthy as he is,
sure,
I think that frees you from a lot of considerations and a lot of obligations and IOUs. But yeah, I agree with you, Paul, that this is a very different style of leadership that we're witnessing here in Connecticut.
And I was surprisingly pleased to see him the other day. I don't know whether you caught this, Gary, in one of his outdoor news conferences. He said, and this was after the Dalio party, partnership had melted away that was, you know, Ray Dalio and his wife. They're still going to donate another $80 million, but the state match is in there, and we got into that because of the freedom of information regulations and everything. It was interesting to hear him say something that I don't think you would have heard again from past Democrats or Republicans, saying that he's asking Len Fasano, the state Senate leader who's leaving on the Republican side, and Joe Arisimowitz, the House Speaker who's leaving, to get together and try to come up with an outline that would allow more public-private partnerships.
Yes.
It looks like, Gary, he was really disappointed at the Dalio thing falling apart.
Well, yeah, that's another aspect of Ned Lamont's governorship that is really quite remarkable and very different than his predecessor, in that he understands the role of the private sector and in stimulating the economy. And he, of course, being from Greenwich himself, he certainly seems to be in that circle of people who really move, you know, have obviously exorbitant wealth. But at the same time, he understands that you can bring people together from both sides of the aisle, and you can also bring in business people, and you can actually, you know, make policy that way. And so, you know, I'm not saying that everything he's done so far has actually succeeded, but at the same time, it's a different approach. Mm-hmm. It's a different approach than what we've seen in the past, and we'll see how that continues, you know, in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and finally, Gary, yeah, that's one thing to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and racial issues that everybody wants to come together on. But,
yeah,
you know, you've seen the same things I have over the past couple of days. You know, the forecast now for the drop-off in state revenue is tremendous. And you know what that's going to mean coming up in the next few sessions. You know,
yeah,
I assume the toll argument will come up again and, you know, pretty drastic tax increases. It may happen.
Well, this is, I think, really going to be in the next several months, next year or so. I think we're really going to see what type of crisis leader Ned Lamont is. I think he's done fairly well during this coronavirus. He's done well in terms of leading the state and certainly trying to be, in many ways, a healer, which a governor has to be, like a president. But I think in terms of real hard decisions, as you mentioned, the deficits that we're going to be facing, then how are we going to deal with that? And what impact is that going to have on social services, education, law enforcement? And I think we're really going to see now what Ned Lamont is really made of because of these, as you say, these looming deficits that are coming.
All right, Gary, thanks. Enjoy the next few weeks. Maybe next time we get together, we'll also, on top of all this, it will have been an alien invasion or something like that that we can lop on to the coronavirus and
stuff like that.
Okay. Which, of course, you'll have to talk to your students about on a video hookup. Right, Gary?
Okay.
Do we know, admit it, we know more about Zoom video conferencing than we ever want to know again, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I've been on WebExes, and I know, and you hear about this Zoom bombing that's going on out there. My God. I mean, what else is next?
It's all we need. Gary, thank you. We'll talk in a few
all
months.
Right.
Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right.
All right. Dr. Gary Rose here, chair of the Poli-Sci Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Go Pioneers.